You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
I'm Tamara Kaufman-Wittes, and on behalf of the Saban Center for Middle East Policy and the Foreign Policy Program here at Brookings, I am delighted to welcome you in Out of the Rain to celebrate the launch of the latest book from our colleague, Saban Center Senior Fellow Bruce Riedel. It is, of course, Avoiding Armageddon, America, India, and Pakistan to the Brink and Back. Copies outside if you didn't get a chance to get one on the way in. Now, Bruce is a senior fellow in the Saban Center, where he's been with us for a number of years. He's also, of course, a former CIA officer, senior advisor to four American presidents on Middle East and South Asian issues, and headed up the interagency review on AFPAC at the beginning of the Obama administration. Those of you who know Bruce at all know what an unusual creature he is in Washington. He is, as that bio tells you, a true expert in a number of areas where expertise is rare and valued. But he's never in a culture that's dominated by a lot of loud voices. He's never the first person to speak in a meeting or a conference. He sits back quietly, as he's doing right now, wondering what I'm going to say next. He listens carefully as others around him spout their views, engage in robust debate, or simply list their talking points. And then in his quiet, measured voice, he cuts through all the chaff with fully formed analysis of astonishing coherence and clarity that persuades everyone in the room that there simply is nothing further to say. But in operating that way, in the Washington context, I think Bruce, over the course of his distinguished career, has truly earned the praise that David Miliband gives him in his blurb on the back cover of this book, that Bruce is expert, honest, rational, and humane. And it is those qualities that he brings to bear in analyzing this truly tricky topic. And we're very grateful to him for doing so. Many of you also know that Bruce is a frequent contributor to the Daily Beast, and we are particularly delighted that the founder and editor-in-chief of the Daily Beast, Tina Brown, is here and has agreed to join us and engage Bruce in a conversation about his new book. So with no further ado, let me turn it over to her. Tina, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much. And it is certainly true that whenever another terrorist gets whacked by a drone, not only am I feel rather festive about the fact that somebody of evil has been removed from the world, the other great thing that happens is I know I'm going to get a wonderful piece from Bruce Riedel. So I have a sort of terribly, a dual reaction every time there's a terrorist who meets his maker, because Bruce writes better about issues of terrorism and AFPAC and the bad guys and what we're doing about the bad guys than anybody else that I can think of quite right now in the commentary world. So
sometimes I feel like an obituary writer.
So let me start with a question about the title of your really brilliant and gripping book, Avoiding Armageddon, which is, that's a very provocative title, Bruce. So have we really been on the edge of Armageddon in South Asia? And if so, how close have we actually been, do you think, in recent years to nuclear war?
First of all, let me thank Tammy and you for this very kind introduction. If you go on any further, I'm going to be as pink as my socks are sitting up here. We spent a lot of time at Brookings debating the title, actually, Avoiding Armageddon, America, India, and Pakistan to the Brink and Back. And I think "and back" is a very important part of this. Every American president since John F. Kennedy has confronted a crisis between India and Pakistan, some larger, some smaller. The last four presidents, starting with Bush the Elder, have confronted crises that had a nuclear dimension. In one case, certainly one case, Bill Clinton, we had a war underway in South Asia, small war, but small wars are real to the warriors just as big wars are real to the warriors, that we now know was careening towards a much broader war. At the time, it was confined to the northern part of Kashmir, but we know the Indians were seriously considering blockading Pakistan's port of Kashmir, which would have escalated the war right away. The morning of the decisive meeting in 1999, the 4th of July 1999, between President Clinton and Prime Minister Sharif at Blair House, the President's Daily Brief, the CIA's top secret newspaper, told the President that Pakistan is arming its nuclear weapons for use. It has to be considered one of the seminal moments of his presidency. He was looking at a very real possibility that if he couldn't persuade Nawaz Sharif to back down, India would escalate the war and Pakistan would respond with a nuclear blast. So I think we came very, very close in 1999.
What was it that changed the dynamic there?
I think at the end of the day we were saved by three individuals. One is Bill Clinton. Second is the Prime Minister of India, who showed remarkable self-restraint. India had been attacked, and he responded in a measured way. But at the end, it was Nawaz Sharif. Nawaz Sharif knew that the course Pakistan was on in 1999 was going to lead to disaster. And he chose, at the last minute, literally, to veer the car in the right way. And he lost his job for it. And he came very close to losing his head, and he went into exile for it. We had a similar crisis in 2001 and 2002 in Bush Jr., when Pakistani terrorists attacked the Indian parliament with the goal of murdering the Indian prime minister. Had they got their timing right, they would have done it. That crisis led to a year-long standoff between India and Pakistan, in which over a million troops were mobilized on both sides. President Obama faced his India-Pakistan crisis, or at least the first one, even before he was inaugurated with the attack on Mumbai in November 2008. There again, the Indian government displayed incredible self-restraint and chose not to respond to an attack that killed 166 people with violence, but to, in effect, turn the other cheek.
And yet the worst part about that bombing, really, is the fact that the perpetrator, the mastermind, Hafiz Saeed, is actually still at large, swanning around in Pakistan, making television broadcasts. I mean, he's hiding in plain sight.
Right.
How could that be? I mean, how can it be that this man who was responsible for the death of all those people in Mumbai is not apprehended, is not in jail, is not, you know, executed, actually?
And he's not alone. The top three most wanted on the U.S. most wanted terrorist list are all in Pakistan. Hafiz Saeed, not hiding at all, as you say. He appears on TV every day. Mullah Omar, the head of the Afghan Taliban, is not hiding either. He's in Quetta, in a safe house of the Pakistani Inter-Services Intelligence Directorate, the Pakistani equivalent to the CIA. Ayman Zawahiri, Osama bin Laden's successor, is theoretically hiding, but I think it's a safe bet that we will find him in something a lot like the safe house that his boss was found in, inside a closed military area. And that gets to the answer to your question, the Pakistani military. The Pakistani army remains obsessed with India. It has been obsessed with India since partition. It has lost every war with India, and losing every war, it has come back even more obsessed with India. It sees no way of ever defeating India conventionally, having tried and failed, and therefore has come up with two strategies to try to even the playing field. One is building nuclear weapons, and Pakistan today has the fastest growing nuclear arsenal in the world, probably in excess of 200 nuclear weapons. And second, is what they refer to euphemistically as asymmetric warfare, which is a fancy term for supporting terrorists. And they are convinced that these strategies work, and they take from the fact that India has not retaliated in these previous cases the argument it works. See? We can do anything we want.
So in that case, if there's a third attack of this kind, it's hard to imagine that India is going to sit on its hands again.
I think that's true. You will hear a healthy debate on this issue. Many in India and Pakistan will argue, no, avoiding Armageddon is too ominous. We know what we're doing. Like you in the Soviet Union during the Cold War, we know how to manage this relationship so that it can go to the edge but won't go over the edge. I hope that's right. I think it's much more likely we're playing Russian roulette.
So what can America's role be in making this intransigent problem, you know, go away? I mean, there have been many, multiple attempts to make these two powers, you know, like each other, and it doesn't seem to be working. And at the same time, you know, we've given Pakistan so much in the way of support and funds, and yet that a poll in June 2012 showed that 74% of the Pakistanis view America as the enemy. So what can this, I mean, we're now about to, you know, starting a second, you know, administration of Obama. What now can be done? What can John Kerry, for instance, put in motion that will do anything, if it is possible to do anything, to change the situation?
We do one thing well and one thing poorly. The thing that we do well is conflict management. We have, in essence, a playbook. When a crisis like this happens, we deploy the Secretary of State, the National Security Advisor, and Secretary of Defense. We round up everyone we can, the British, the French, the Chinese, all to go in and urge restraint. So far, we've been very successful in doing that. What we're very weak at is conflict resolution. The problem, though, is that if you look at the 70-year history of America's relationship with India and Pakistan, I would argue, and I try to argue in the book, that we have a demonstrated capacity to make the situation worse. And we're good at that. We support the dictators. We give millions, billions of dollars to Pakistani dictators. We tend to undermine the civilian government. We know how to irritate and antagonize our Indian friends. There's not much evidence that we're very good at moving the situation in the right direction. But I think there are opportunities ahead. Our relationship with India today is better than it's ever been before. The U.S.-India civil nuclear deal, whatever you think of its merits in terms of arms control, has taken away the biggest irritant in our relationship. Trade between the United States and India is growing. Military relations are growing. Because we have stood by them in cases like the Kargil War, we have more trust in Delhi than we've ever had before. Same can't be said, obviously, in Islamabad. Our relationship there is as bad as it can be. But I think that the challenge that John Kerry and the president have is to try to nurture India and Pakistan together. They've got to take the lead. We can cheer them on. The good news is there's an increasing body on both sides that recognize that the path of going to crisis and crisis is insanity. When, in fact, India and Pakistan today could, through a productive relationship, create nirvana in South Asia. If you harnessed the entrepreneurial talent of India and Pakistan together, I think you would create an economic prosperity zone that would make the European Union be a distant memory and would outdo China.
Yeah, there's escalating sectarian bloodshed now in Pakistan, and Malik Ishaq was just arrested this week for stirring anti-Shiite hatred. And he's roamed free for all this time, like Syed has. So, I mean, what chance is there of Pakistan ending impunity finally for known terrorists? I mean, we know that we didn't even want to tell the Pakistanis when we went in to get Osama bin Laden. And surely nothing can really change unless they actually deal with their own problem inside Pakistan of terrorists, either attacking Mumbai or attacking the West.
Exactly. Pakistan today is a country under siege. It is the world's number one patron state sponsor of terrorism. It is probably also one of the world's number one victims of terrorism. And the two are related. American presidents, and I've watched four of them do it, have been telling Pakistanis for a quarter of a century, if you patronize terrorism, it will ultimately consume you. We have the virtue of knowing we were right. Now the question is, how do we move it forward? I think there are fragile signs of a real debate for the first time in Pakistan on this issue. That's what I call the battle for the soul of Pakistan. There are voices out there which are saying this is a self-destructive policy. We can't continue on this road. Now, so far, those voices are still pretty small, and they have yet to move the army and the jihadist forces in Pakistan, and it will be very hard to do it. Our objective has to be to help those people. Not only are they moving the country, or do they want to move the country in the right direction, they're doing it at incredible risk to themselves. The girl, Malala, was shot in the head by the Taliban. That's the battle for the soul of Pakistan. My first rule in a situation like this, in terms of policy advice, is do no harm. That's easy to say and actually very hard to do in Pakistan, because in Pakistan, for reasons of our own self-defense, we do harm ourselves every day with drone strikes. It's a very difficult balance. But we have to constantly be thinking about ways to try to move this battle for the soul of Pakistan in the right direction, and certainly try to do nothing that hinders those voices.
How much has the war in Afghanistan been a bad thing for Pakistan? I mean, if you talk to certain people who are friendly towards Pakistan, they say, well, so much of their turbulence and instability and terrorism has been caused by refugees coming from Afghanistan, radical elements coming from Afghanistan. Is there any truth in that?
There is. There's a lot of truth. We see this as a war that's now 10 years old. Afghans and Pakistanis see this as a war that's 30 years old. And if you look at it in those terms, Pakistan has suffered tremendously. The Kalashnikov culture that dominates Pakistani cities today, that makes places like Quetta or Karachi murder capitals of the world, is a product of the spillover from all of these Afghan wars, not just the current one, but all of these Afghan wars. The Pakistani military and intelligence love affair with terrorist groups like Lashkar-e-Taiba, like Lashkar-e-Jangvi, the one that attacks Shias, all date back to the start of this war and to decisions made by Zia-ul-Haq at the beginning of the war. The American role in all of this has generally been to support the generals in Islamabad. Ronald Reagan loved Zia-ul-Haq.
How badly do you think Bush, too, was conned by Musharraf? I mean, it feels as if he was just completely taken in by Musharraf. Is that true?
I think that's very true. The former Afghan foreign minister, Abdullah Abdullah, has this great phrase about the relationship between Musharraf and Bush. And he says, Musharraf threw dust in Bush's eyes. And I think it's true. I think he was very good at that. The generals are experts at telling us what we want to hear and convincing us that they're serious, while at the same time they're not. President Obama, I think, falls into a different category. And you hinted at it, and just to expand on the point, you know, when he sent the SEAL team into Abbottabad to kill Osama bin Laden. At that point, the United States had provided Pakistan with $25 billion in military and economic assistance in 10 years. That's even more than we gave Israel in those 10 years. And any time you're giving some other country more money than you're giving Israel, you are really in an unusual position. And we gave them all that money for one purpose, to fight Al-Qaeda. And at the moment of truth, the president made the right decision. He couldn't trust the Pakistanis with that information. I think everything we've seen since then underscores that.
So where has that left us, though? I mean, given that we did go in and we did get Osama bin Laden, I mean, the fact that Mullah Omar and Zawahiri and so on are still there and nothing's happened. I mean, I actually thought naively that perhaps after Osama was killed, you'd see the Pakistanis kind of giving up the others. But it doesn't seem to have happened. And, I mean, what is their state of being about this now? What is their rationale for this appalling thing?
The army remains obsessed with India. That is what drives their policy. If you ask Chief of Army Staff General Kayani what is the nature of his being, he will tell you, I am obsessed with India. Mm-hmm. So how do we break this? We can't do it, but we can help Indians and Pakistanis do it. It needs to be done at several levels. One is people-to-people contact, increasing that. Up until 1965, Indians and Pakistanis could cross the border without a visa. Now the only people who can cross the border without a visa have to be over 90 and under 9. And the ISI and its Indian equivalent look at every visa application as an opportunity to say no, not as an opportunity to say yes. People are beginning to look at this. India and Pakistan are changing those things. Trade as well. India and Pakistan could have a vibrant direct trade. The Economist, for example, estimates that within 5 years, if they lifted some tariff regulations on both sides, they could quadruple trade. That's one part. Another part, though, has to be resolving the Kashmir issue. Kashmir is the issue that divides Indians and Pakistanis. There's no escaping it. American presidents since John F. Kennedy have tried to escape the Kashmir issue as too hard, too difficult to deal with. And certainly if we appointed a special negotiator for Kashmir, he would never, ever, ever get a visa to go to New Delhi. You can count on it. But we need to be more subtle. We need to be a little more indirect. We need to be a cheerleader for Indians and Pakistanis doing this. Musharraf, who we've dissed pretty thoroughly here, to be fair to him, after he tried nuclear blackmail, terrorism, a small war, came around to negotiations and negotiated indirectly with Prime Minister Vajpayee and then Prime Minister Singh the basic outlines of a deal. We need to get back to that deal.
Now, what do you think is going to happen in the forthcoming elections in Pakistan?
The forthcoming elections, in fact,
Does Imran Khan have any kind of a chance?
No.
He was good in Davos, what can I say?
He's very good. He's very articulate. He understands a lot of the problem. Mm. But Pakistani politics are run by two political parties. And if you don't have the grassroots networks, you're not really competing, and he doesn't have the grassroots network. The way to think about Pakistani elections is simple. Essentially, they're having a runoff between the winners and losers of the 1988 election every year since 1988. 1988, Nawaz Sharif and Benazir Bhutto went at it for the first time, and in 2013, they'll go at it for a second time, only she's dead, but her husband will be the stand-in. If you think of it in those terms, it's not hard to understand why Pakistanis are desperate for Imran Khan or anybody, a Martian, anybody to come on the scene and have something different to say. But they're likely to be disappointed. All that said, this year, assuming there is not a military coup or something like that, Pakistan will cross a huge threshold. For the first time in its history, an elected government will serve out its full term. There will be an election, and a new elected government will take its place. Now, that may not seem like a big deal, but for Pakistan, that's a huge deal. And this gets back to the question, how do we help Pakistan? Well, we want to encourage this process.
What do you think can be expected now for women in Pakistan? I mean, we were all, as you mentioned, very shocked by the whole Malala incident. If you talk to anybody there, they say that actually Malala was just one that we happened to hear about, but there's plenty of that going on every month. So What kind of protection do you think can be offered to women in Pakistan and in Afghanistan now, in terms of the troops pulling out, in terms of the, you know, the sectarian violence? Is this going to get worse for women now?
I think that we're certainly in for a very rough next 2 years. The confluence of Pakistan's elections, the turnover in command of the Pakistani army, the chief of army staff changes this year, NATO, America drawdown in Afghanistan, elections in Afghanistan, the forces of militancy, of terrorism, of jihadism, of violence are going to see all of these as opportunities to try to veer the situation in the worst possible direction. Our ability to do much to help people in Pakistan is pretty limited. You quoted the numbers. We now outpoll India as the bad guy in Pakistan.
And is that a result of the drone policy?
No, it's the drones have added to it, but it's unfair to blame the drones for that. 60 years of American foreign policy has created this. Pakistanis believe that the United States treats their country like a tissue, use it and throw it away. They actually have a different terminology, but I'll stick with tissue in this audience. And any objective review of U.S.-Pakistani relations, I think, would have to argue they're right. That's where we are. In the State Department, they like to call it the trust deficit. Such an innocuous term, you know, the trust deficit. This is not what it is. They hate us. They absolutely hate us. They may admire things about America, about our democracy, about our entrepreneurship, but they hate our foreign policy. And the drones is only the latest part of that. The challenge here is, with all of that baggage, let's not make it worse first, and then let's look for ways to help Malala and others like that by being on the side of democracy, good governance, the rule of law, accountability.
Well, thank you, Bruce. You've now made me incredibly threatened, depressed, and neurotic. So, I'd love to turn it now to the audience to see if you're... I'm sure there's lots of questions. Yes, over here. Yes, he's just coming with a mic. Maybe you want to self-identify when you stand up.
Thank you very much. My name is Malik Siraj Akbar. I'm a journalist from Pakistan. In your book, you talk extensively about the relationships between the U.S. Presidents and the Indian or Pakistani prime ministers. How much do you think have the U.S. presidents' personal experience of traveling to the region or their experiences of having been there have influenced or added to improving the relationship, like the way you talk about President Nixon's relationship towards the region and his problems with Indira Gandhi, for instance? So has the U.S. had a policy towards India and Pakistan, or has it been like personality-driven based on personal contacts and relationships? Thank you.
One of the most fun things in researching this book was studying each American president and their relationship with India and Pakistan. And I think I am now prepared to go on any trivia contest. And when it says American presidents in South Asia, to take that knowing I think I know all the answers. I'll give you one. Then I'm going to come to your important question. The American president who spent more time in South Asia than any other, Ulysses S. Grant. Because when he went,
he couldn't get away because of the travel.
Right. When he went in the 1870s, you couldn't just go for an hour. You had to go. It was an investment of time. And he spent more than a month. How important is it? Critically important. Presidents are like people everywhere. They tend to think in personal terms. Bush and Mush, he thought he was looked into his eyes and couldn't trust him. You can criticize his judgment, but you can understand how he got there. I think Obama, famously known for not being one of the world's great bonders, has bonded pretty well with Singh. The two of them seem to find a common ground. The danger with Pakistan right now is that we've lost any hope of trying to get those bonds. I think one of the interesting phenomena of this first Obama administration is how each of the principals in the cabinet at one point or another basically decided, I'm not doing Pakistan anymore. I've had it.
But is that because, who are you bonding with is the point. I mean, Zardari, for instance, what is he like? And then clearly when you try to bond with him, you've got the army kind of bond with too.
Right.
So, is it a dual-pronged effort to win both these people, or is it hopeless?
It's got to be engagement across the board. But engagement with your eyes wide open. Just because they tell you what you want to hear doesn't mean they're going to do it. And we have to engage with what we have. President Zardari is a crook. Okay. He's referred to as Mr. 10%. A Pakistani I talked to today said, no, he's Mr. 100%. He takes everything if he can get it. That said, President Zardari's vision of Pakistan is fundamentally different than that of the generals. He wants Pakistan to be at peace with India. He wants to stop fighting terrorism. That's why the Mumbai attack happened, was they wanted to sabotage that, and they'd sabotaged it very well. So there's no shortcut here. Engagement is the only alternative, but it's got to be engagement with our eyes wide open.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yes.
Thanks very much. I'm Garrett Mitchell, and I write the Mitchell Report and read all of Bruce's books. I was thinking about the question of policy options in a situation like this, and you began by saying, first, do no harm, which I think is what you said not so long ago about the Sunni-Shia divide that we're faced with. In the current issue of Foreign Affairs, Ambassador Haqqani has defined a new kind of relationship between the U.S. and Pakistan, and I won't elaborate on what that is, but we'll make a presumption that you're familiar with it. What do you think about the validity of what he's proposing? And second, in what ways is it the same as or different from the first do no harm recommendation that you're making?
Ambassador Haqqani is a close friend, and he is, if you want me to give you an example of people fighting for the soul of Pakistan, here's one. The man who wrote the book about how the military controls the politics of the country and then went on to serve as ambassador of that same state because he knew that there was no shortcut. There's no shortcut to talking. He's referred to as the need for a divorce. I think this marriage is over. So I don't know why we need to go through the legal process of divorce. It is certainly one of the most broken marriages. I mean, there's not a character in Dallas that can rival the U.S.-Pakistan relationship. But we still need to talk to each other. And we're not going to get away from that. And we need to find ways to help people like Hussein Haqqani. It's not easy to do. When we put our arms around them, they get called home and have their passports taken away and are almost killed. So we're going to have to be more subtle here. But one of the things we need to do, and I think he would agree with me on this, is stop thinking about these countries in isolation and start thinking of them holistically. I think one of the mistakes President made in his first term was halfback. It's a very poorly phrased term. Most Pakistanis do not like to be referred to as a PAK. Very few Afghans want to be referred to as an AF. It also makes your thinking about the region perverted. We need to think of the region as united. That's why I keep saying, do no harm, but also encourage those who are trying to move in the right direction. India wants increased trade with Pakistan. Let's be on the same wavelength. Let's promote it. Let's increase trade ourselves with Pakistan.
This gentleman here.
Thank you. My name is Elliot Hurwitz, and I'm retired. My name is Elliot Hurwitz, and I'm retired. Mr. Rydell, I have a question for you, although it is a difficult question. RPVs.
All the other ones were easy.
RPVs, also known as drones, create turmoil in southern Asia and everywhere else in the world. In your judgment, are the advantages of RPVs greater than the disadvantages?
Okay, you're right. This is of the many difficult questions, one of the most difficult. Let me begin with a little bit of perspective. The drones began under President Bush. The first use of drones in a systematic way was in 2007. At that time, in 2007, the policy of the administration was to give Pakistan advance notice of lethal drone strikes. It seemed like a common courtesy. We're attacking people in their country. We should let them know it's coming. Every single time we did that, the target wasn't there when the missile arrived. And they did it enough that it was, let's say, a statistically significant database. You don't have to be Sherlock Holmes to connect these dots. Someone who was getting the advance notice was telling the terrorists. That changed at the end of the Bush administration. By the time President Obama came into office, he inherited a fully mature program ready to operate. What do I mean by that? Not just unmanned aerial vehicles in the air, but intelligence officers on the ground who could tell you where to find the bad guys. Over the course of the last 4 years, that program has significantly degraded al-Qaeda's capabilities. It has not defeated al-Qaeda. It has not destroyed al-Qaeda, but it has significantly degraded. In the absence of Pakistan taking action against these targets, this is the only way the president has to deal with the problem. But it comes with a cost. It comes with a very big cost. It adds to Pakistan's anger at America. The challenge here for Obama and his team is to avoid drone addiction, to see the drone as the answer to every problem, and to be extremely selective. Now, that's really easy to say in Falk Auditorium on Massachusetts Avenue. It's a lot more complicated to turn that into practice when the CIA comes to you and says, here's Mr. Bad Guy. We want to take him out. We know where he is, and we have a window. One of the things that I think has been healthy about the debate about John Brennan becoming director of CIA is we're finally having a serious conversation in this country about how much is enough, how much is too much. And I think from what I've read of what Mr. Brennan thinks about these things, he understands that we need to have a more rigorous process of doing this and that we can't see a drone is the answer to every security threat we face. But on the other hand, we can't throw it away.
Thank you, this gentleman here. He's been trying to get it.
Thank you. I'm Dr. Nisar Chaudhry with Pakistan American League. Bruce, you mentioned about a survey about Pakistan's people, almost 74 or 75% are anti Americans. I think this survey becomes questionable because about 700,000 Pakistani Americans, Pakistani diaspora, lives in this country, and they are very proud of their adopted land, and they are also ambassadors of goodwill for USA. They inherit the East, they have adopted the West. I think 75% of people might disagree with the policies towards Pakistan. But people of Pakistan love people of America. American people are wonderful people. The best friends I have, they're all Americans, and you know it very well inside the Beltway. So I think that survey becomes a little questionable when it comes to people of Pakistan against Americans. They are not against Americans. They love to be here. They love America. They love their way of life, and especially the American virtues. My question is that USA has plans to withdraw from Afghanistan, and NATO forces also. There could be some residual force inside Afghanistan. When all these forces, which is a huge number, comes out, and people in that area has a hobby of fighting, this is a game for them, like hunting, fishing. What could be the possible fallout, and how can we develop a regional approach? Because all these three countries, their stability as well as their territorial integrity is interdependent. And as you mentioned, seen elements are in every country
right.
who want
right.
understanding. Can America play such a role to bring all these three countries on the table? Because America does have a leverage in that region.
Before I address your question, yes, there's a huge Pakistani-American community, there's a huge Indian-American community, a huge Bangladeshi-American community, and we need to use those bridges in the future more creatively than we've used them in the past. That is an asset we have. They are incredibly successful communities as well. The United States is certainly not going to be able to do the second thing until it starts looking at this problem in a regional scope. So my first response is I'm hoping to see the revival of South Asia Bureau in the State Department and its mutation in the White House and in the Pentagon. We need to think about the area holistically if we're going to have a holistic policy. Afghanistan itself, let's also put a little perspective on this. When Barack Obama inherited the Afghan war in January 2009, we were on the verge of a catastrophic defeat. In the report I wrote to the president then, the section on Afghanistan was entitled, "We are losing the war, but it is not yet lost." We had neglected for 7 years the fundamentals in Afghanistan. We thought that security would come from magic, not from building security forces. We embarked on a 5-year program, and we're now close to the end. We have created that security force. We are now withdrawing and transitioning to them. There is no guarantee this will work. I call it a gamble. It is a huge gamble. We don't have an alternative. We can't stay in Afghanistan. We can't keep 100,000 Americans there. We can't afford this. We're broke. But it is a gamble. It needs to be, we need to go through this gamble in as cautious a way as possible, not recklessly. We cannot simply walk away from Afghanistan. You mentioned Afghan girls. 4 million Afghan girls are going to school today. We can't throw those people under the bus. We will need to maintain some residual presence. It will be much cheaper than what we're doing now. It will require, though, a willingness to stick at this longer than most Americans, I think, have the willingness to. But here's the bottom line. We've abandoned Afghanistan before, arguably twice, in 1989 and in 2002. And we see what the result is. So if you made a mistake twice and you do it a third time, that's not tragic. That's criminal.
We have time for one last question, so I'm just going to... Let me take something from the back here, over here. Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Sajjad Durrani. I'm a retired person also, originally from Pakistan. I have a comment and a question. You said Pakistan is the foremost sponsor of terrorism. I thought Iran used to have that privilege. When did you change that to Pakistan? But the question I have is, you mentioned very correctly that the big difference between India and Pakistan and the reason for their antagonism over all these years is the issue of Kashmir. And you just sort of switched it away. There are Security Council resolutions. There are all kind of other things that U.S. could do to help resolve that issue and then bring the two countries together. What can you recommend for that?
Well, it's certainly a close race between Iran and Pakistan. But I think if you look at numbers of terrorist organizations, Pakistan, I think, has pride of place. A dubious distinction, one which is destroying the country. According to the government of Pakistan, since 9/11, 45,000 Pakistanis have died in terrorist-related incidents. Since 9/11, there have been 300 suicide bombings in Pakistan. Before 9/11, there was one. This is a country which is being consumed by the militancy that it has chosen to sponsor over the years. The good news is more and more Pakistanis are aware of this. Problem of Kashmir, we can't impose a solution, but we can certainly facilitate a solution. I'll give you one practical aspect. When India and Pakistan, if India and Pakistan, can reach some agreement on how to defuse it, it will need to go to the Security Council for global international blessing. That's up our alley. You know, that's where we specialize in things like that. We can also help in building a coalition of states to support them when they do this, from the Chinese to the Saudis to the British to all those who have a stake in the outcome. So it's not the classic American solution. The classic American solution is let's appoint a special negotiator. But, you know, we can be a little more subtle. We can be a little more indirect. We certainly need to work with the parties, but we can also be there with the parties to transfer an idea into reality.
Thank you so much, Bruce. Very fascinating book, everybody, if you get a chance to read it. It's gripping. It will keep you up at night. It did me. And I want to thank Bruce Riedel, who is so knowledgeable and so gripping in his analysis. Thank you, Bruce.
Thank you, Tina. Thank you. Thank you.